After the squalor and close quarters of Phoebe, the spacious, well-lit corridors of Thoth Station felt like distilled luxury. Wide, white halls that curved with a near-organic grace. Team workspaces and individual carrels both. I slept in a private room no longer than a medieval monk's cell, but I shared it with no one. I ate cultured steak, as tender and rich as the best that Earth had to offer, and drank wine indistinguishable from the real thing. The local climate, free from the temperature inertia carried by Phoebe's 8 quadrillion tons of ice, remained balmy and pleasant. Thoth boasted a research staff larger and better qualified than the universities on Earth or Luna, and the equal of even the best on Mars. The nanoinformatics team grew larger than before, even counting the loss of our Martian naval colleagues. Instead of only Trin and Lay and Quintana, I could now talk through my ideas about the protomolecule with a professional musician turned information engineer named Boothers and an ancient-looking woman named Althea Echo, who I didn't realize for almost a week authored half of my textbooks from Tel Aviv. And Lodge and Kenzie and Jacobson and Alfarmi and Brown. We sat up nights in the common rooms, mixing now and then with the other groups, biochemistry, signaling theory, morphology, physical engineering, chemical engineering, logical engineering, and on, until it seemed like Thoth represented every specialty that cutting-edge research could invent. Like the coffeehouses of Muslim Spain, we created civilization among ourselves. Or at least it felt that way. It might only have been the romance of the times. Everyone in research had undergone the treatment, which admittedly posed some problems. Singh, in computational biology, held forth on her theory of the protomolecule as a Guzman-style quantum computer one night over dinner, and when Kibushi used the information without citing her, she snuck into the showers at the gymnasium and beat him to death with a ceramic workbench cap. After that, security kept a closer eye on us all, and they also switched to non-lethal weapons. Singh, while formally reprimanded by Dresden, kept her status on her team. It only tended to confirm what we all already knew. Morality, as we had known it, no longer applied to us. We had become too important for consequences. We prepared then, and we waited. The tension of every day growing more refined and exquisite. Rumors swirled of the sample going awry and being recovered, of information ops plans put in place to distract any possible regulatory bodies from our work, until they also understood the transcendent importance of what we would have accomplished, of our sister research stations on Io and Osiris Station, and the smaller projects they were engaged with. None of it mattered. Even the greatest war in human history would have been paltry compared with our work. To bend the protomolecule to our own will. To direct the flow of information now as whatever alien brilliance had done before opened the concept of humanity beyond anything that even we were capable of imagining. If we managed what we hoped, the sacrifice of Eros Station would unlock literally anything we could imagine. The prospect of the protomolecule's designers arriving to find humans unprepared for their invasion gave us, or me at any rate, that extra chill of fear. I had no compunctions, no sense of regret. I'd had it burned out of me. But I believe that even if I'd refused the procedure, I would have done precisely as I did. I'm smart enough to know that this is almost certainly not true, but I believe it. The word came nearly at the end of shift one day. Eros would be online in 17 hours. No one slept that night. No one even tried. I ate dinner, chicken fezzanjan and jeweled rice with Trin and Lodge, the three of us leaning over the tall, slightly wobbly table and talking fast, as if we could will time to pass more quickly. On other nights, we would have gone back to our rooms, let ourselves be locked in by security, watch whatever entertainments the heavily censored company feeds provided. That night, we went back to the labs, and worked a full second shift. We checked all our connection arrays, ran sample sets, prepared. When the data came in, it would be as a broadcast, available everywhere. We only had to listen, and so tracking us through that signal became impossible. The price of this anonymity was high. There would be no rerunning a missed sample, no second chances. The equipment on Eros, both the most important and the most vulnerable, lay beyond our control, so we obsessed over what we could reach. My station, and the center of my being, had a wall-sized screen, a multiple-valence interface, and the most comfortable chair I've ever had. The water tasted of cucumber, citrus, and oxyracetam. The stations for Lay, Lodge, and Quintana shared my space, the four of us facing away from each other in a floor plan like the petals of a very simple flower. Eros had 1.5 million people in an enclosed environment, 7,000 weather station-style data collection centers in the public corridors, and Protogen-coded software updates on all the asteroid station's environmental controls, including the air and water recycling systems. Each of us waited for the data to come, hungry for the cells in our databases to begin filling, the patterns we felt certain would be there to emerge. Every minute lasted 2. My sleep-deprived body seemed to vibrate in my chair, as if my blood had found the perfect resonance frequency for the room and would slowly tear it apart. Lay sighed and coughed and sighed again, until the only things that kept me from attacking her out of raw annoyance were the security guard outside our door, and the certainty it would mean missing the beginning of our data stream. Quintana cheered first, and then Lay, and then all of us together, howling with joy that felt sweeter for being so long delayed. The data poured in, filling the cells of our analytic spreadsheets and databases. For those first beautiful hours, I traced the changes on a physical map of Eros Station. The protomolecule activity began at the shelters that we'd converted to incubators, feeding the smart particles with the radiation that seemed to best drive activity. It spread along the transit tunnels, out to the casino levels, the maintenance tunnels, the docks. It eddied through the caves of Eros like a vast breath, the greatest act of transformation in the history of the human race and the tree of life from which it sprang, and I, along with a handful of others, watched it unfold in an awe that approached religious ecstasy. I want to say that I honored the sacrificed population, that I took a moment in my heart to thank them for the contribution they were all unwittingly making for the future that they left behind. The sort of thing you're trained to say about any lab animals advanced enough to be cute. And maybe I did. But my fascination with the protomolecule and its magic, that isn't too strong a word, overwhelmed any sentimentality I had about our methods. How long did it take before we understood how badly we'd underestimated the task? In my memory, it is almost instantaneous, but I know that isn't true. Certainly for the first day, 2 days, 3, we must have withheld judgment. So little time afforded us, meaning me, only a very narrow slice of the overall data set. But too soon the complexity on Eros outstripped us. The models based on examinations in the lab and the human exposure on Phoebe returned values that seesawed between incomprehensible and trivial. The protomolecule's ability to make use of high-level structures, organs, hands, brains, caught me off guard. The outward aspect of the infection skipped from being explicable in terms of simple cause and effect through the intentional stance and into a kind of beautiful madness. What is it doing? To what does it want? To what is it doing again? I kept diving through the dataset, trying one analytical strategy and then another, hoping that somewhere in the numbers and projections I would find it looking back out at me. I didn't sleep. I ate rarely. The others followed suit. Trin suffered a psychotic break, which proved something of a blessing as it marked the end of her coughing and sighs. Listening to the voices of Eros, human voices of the subjects preserved even as the flesh had been remade, reconfigured, I came to grips with the truth. Too many simplifying assumptions, too little imagination on our part, and the utter alienness of the protomolecule conspired to overthrow all our best intentions. The behavior of the particles had changed not only in scale, but in kind, and continued to do so again at increasingly narrow intervals. The sense of watching a countdown grew into a certainty, though to what I couldn't say. I should probably have been afraid. With every new insight in the long, unbroken stretch of consciousness that predates even humanity, a first moment comes. For an hour, or a day, or a lifetime, something new has come into the world. Recognized or not, it exists in only one mind, secret and special. It is the bone-shaking joy of finding a novel species or a new theory that explains previously troubling data. The sensation can range from something deeper than orgasm to a small, quiet, rapturous voice whispering that everything you'd thought before was wrong. Someone would have to be brilliant and driven and, above all, lucky to have even a handful of moments like that in the span of a stellar and celebrated career. I had 5 or 6 of them every shift. Each one felt better than love, better than sex, better than drugs. The few times I slept through dreams of pattern matching and data analysis, and woke to the quivering promise that this time, today, the insight might come that made it all make sense. The line that connected the dots, all the dots, forever. I lived on the edge of revelation like I could dance in the flames and not burn. When the end came, it surprised me. It found me in my cell, silent in the dark, not awake and not asleep, the bed cradling me in its palm like an acorn. The sharp scent of the air recycler's fresh filters reminded me of rain. The voices I heard, clipped, angry syllables, I ascribed the combination of listening to Eros for hours on end and the hypnagogic twilight of my mind. When the door opened and the 3 men from security hauled me out, I could almost have believed it was part of my dream. Seconds later, the alarms shrieked. I still don't know how the Belters discovered Thoth Station. Some technical failure, some oversight that left the trail that came to us, the inevitable information leakage that comes from working with people. Station security pushed us like cattle, hurrying us down the corridors. I assumed our path ended in evacuation craft. It didn't. In the labs, they lined us up at our workstations. Fong commanded the group in my room. It was the first time I'd recognized her as anything but another anonymous extension of the lump of biomass and demands that was security. She gestured to our workstations with her non-lethal riot gun. All their weapons were designed for controlling research, not defending the station. "Purge it," Fong said. "Purge everything." She might as well have told us to chew our fingers off. Lodge crossed her arms. Quintana spat on the floor. Fear glinted in Fong's eyes, but we defied her. It felt like nobility at the time. 10 minutes later, the Belters broke through. They wore no standard uniform, carried no unified weapons. They shouted and screamed in shattered bits of 6 languages. A young man with tattoos on his face led the charge. I watched Fong's eyes as she reached her conclusion and lifted her hands over her head. We did as she did, and the Belters surrounded us, peppering us with questions I couldn't follow and whooping in a violence-drunk delight. They threw me to the deck and tied my hands behind my back. 2 of them carried Lei away as she threatened them with extravagant violence. I don't know what happened to her after that. I never saw her again. I lay with my cheek pressed to the floor harder than I thought the low gravity would allow. I watched their boots and listened to the chatter of their voices. At my workstation, an analysis run ended with a chime and waited for attention that would never come. less than 2 meters from me. The new interpretation that might have been the one, that might have cracked open the mystery, waited for my eyes, and I couldn't get to it. In that moment, I understood fully the depth of the abyss before me. I begged to look at the results. I whined, I wept, I cursed. The belters ignored me. Hours later, they hauled me to the docks and into a hastily rigged holding cell. A man with a hand terminal and an accent almost too thick to parse demanded my name and identification. When I told him I didn't have a union representative to contact, he asked if I had family. I said no to that, too. We burned at something like a third of a G, but without a hand terminal or access to a control panel, I lost track of time quickly. Twice, a pair of young men came and beat me, shouting threats to do worse. They stopped only when the larger of the two started weeping and couldn't be consoled. I recognized the docking maneuvers only by the shifting vectors of the ship. We had arrived at wherever we were going, for however long we were meant to stay there. Guards came, hauled me out, shoved me in a line with the others from Thoth. They marched us as prisoners, or animals. I felt the loss of the experiment like mourning a death, only worse. Because out there, like hell being the absence of God, the experiment was still going on, but it had left me behind. They kept us in an enormous room.